May it please the court and opposing counsel, my name is Keith Harvett. I am one of the attorneys representing the defendant DLR Group in this case. This is a breach of contract case. The standard measure of damages in a breach of contract action is the benefit of the bargain measured at the time of breach. This case involves a subcontract for consulting services and a design build project between the plaintiff, North Star Project Management, and the defendant, DLR Group, which is a national architectural engineering firm. The subcontract at issue in this case is a firm fixed fee subcontract. The underlying construction project was funded by the U.S. Department of Energy, and as such, this case also involves publicly funded taxpayer dollars. The defendant's total fee pursuant to its subcontract with the plaintiff was in the amount of $226,882. After withholding and failing and refusing to pay the defendant, the invoiced remaining amount due and owing of $110,502.84, the plaintiff terminated the subcontract and proceeded to file suit. The jury trial in this case was held between March 1st and March 4th of 2010. At the conclusion of the plaintiff's case in chief, the defendant made a motion for directed verdict, which was overruled. The jury subsequently returned a verdict in favor of the plaintiff and against the defendant in the amount of $40,683.16. Following the retirement of the trial judge, the district court overruled the defendant's motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, or in the alternative, a motion for new trial filed pursuant to Rule 59. The district court subsequently awarded the plaintiff attorney's fees in the amount of $159,617.50, costs in the amount of $8,039.88, and prejudgment interest in the amount of $4,310.28.
Mr. Harvett, I'm curious. You have not endorsed any part of the record regarding jury instructions. In light of paragraph 15 of the contract, where the parties waive consequential damages, how did the jury instruction end up getting to the jury that allowed them to consider the cost of enforcing the agreement?
And Your Honor, that's part of the appeal, obviously. The defendant objected to any of that being considered by the jury. It was overruled by the trial judge. That's Exhibit 136. The sole basis of that award, Your Honor, or that part of the verdict was...
I don't see any argument in the record where the judge was told, hey judge, you can't give this instruction to the jury because paragraph 15 of the contract specifically precludes it.
And I'm not, Your Honor, I don't think that paragraph 15 of the contract was ever raised by either one of the parties as far as that was concerned. The jury instructions were solely based on the breach of contract. Proving the contract, the plaintiff performed, the defendant breached, and resulting damages. And that's the basis of the appeal, is the number four provision of the breach of contract, which is resulting damages. And it's the defendant's position in this case that the plaintiff failed to prove those resulting damages based on the benefit of the bargain. The only way that the jury was able to get to the point it got in this case was because of the errors that were committed by the trial judge as far as the invoiced amount and getting to the verdict that ultimately went against the defendant. When the court looks at the record, the total subcontract I already mentioned was $226,882. The amount billed by the defendant at the time of termination was $144,702.84.
Well, she held back, or North Star, excuse me, held back $110,000.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And proved 80, $81,000 in damages.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
And proved about $81,000 in damages.
Well, I think that the plaintiff is probably going to tell you something different as far as that's concerned, Your Honor. But the only way that we can get to that amount is if you take, at the time of termination, $144,702 that was billed. The plaintiff paid $34,200. I mean, none of those figures are disputed.
Aware of your math.
Okay.
And your suggestion as to the rationale.
Okay, Your Honor, and then
I'm just referring to the testimony of Ms. Thompson.
Right, and that's where all these figures come from, Your Honor. I mean, none of these figures are contested. The amount, as Your Honor just mentioned, $110,502.84 was held in a separate account until 10 days before trial when Ms. Thompson removed that amount. The jury was allowed to consider Exhibit 105, which came to an amount of $72,084. The plaintiff is making an argument that that amount was actually spent. When the court actually looks at the record, the testimony was, okay, so does the $72,000 represent costs you incurred to enforce the contract? No, it does not. It's just a deduction against their fee. That's correct. The plaintiff was withholding at that point $38,000 for work that the defendant actually did do. Once again, Ms. Thompson's testimony, okay, did you withhold from DLR an amount of money related to work that they actually did do? Yes, I did. How much? $38,000. So if you take the 110 minus the 72, you have the 38.
Mr. Harvett, let me ask you this. If we were to agree that the numbers don't add up, what should be the remedy? A remand for consideration, further consideration of damages by the trial court? Or are we empowered to make a ruling as a matter of law as to what amounts, if any, are due DLR?
That's a good question, Your Honor. That's exactly what I was thinking of as I've been preparing for the oral argument. I don't think that the plaintiff gets another bite at the apple on a remand. The plaintiff didn't show damages. They don't get a trial over again by bringing somebody from Oz Architecture or somebody else that was hired after the defendant was terminated. Now, whether this court can use the damages that were testified to by Ms. Thompson and award the defendant a verdict, I'm not sure if that's correct either, or you just need instructions back to the trial court. What I stopped before was at the $38,000 that the Ms. Thompson admittedly owed the defendant at the time she terminated the contract. The only other testimony in this case was that she incurred another $19,000 for out-of-pocket expenses. Well, once again, Ms. Thompson specifically testified that she was withholding $38,000 for the payment of work that the defendant actually did do. So it's the defendant's contention that you don't get to knock off another $19,000. But for, you know, that's what happened in this case. It's the only way we can get to the verdict. So at this point, if you take every reasonable interpretation of the evidence in the plaintiff's favor, at the time of the termination of the contract, the plaintiff still owed the defendant $19,418.84. Under any reasonable interpretation, under any figures that come from Ms. Thompson's testimony. Then we get to the enforcement contract, or the enforcement provision of the contract that Judge Graham had asked me about earlier. The plaintiff was awarded $60,102 under a clause in the contract which says, NSPM shall be entitled to recover from consultant all expenses NSPM incurs for enforcing any terms of this agreement, including without limitation attorney's fees. That is shown on Exhibit 136. This court will see Ms. Thompson kept track of her time, her regularly approved hourly rate from NREL, from 2 months before the defendant was terminated, all the way through time of trial. She was billing her costs, her time for attending depositions, preparing for trial, consultations with her attorney, and that's how it turned from what should have been a verdict in the defendant's favor under any interpretation of the evidence into a verdict in the plaintiff's favor in the amount of $40,683.16. That's the only way that this court can possibly address those numbers. Plaintiff made an argument, at least during the briefs, about that the defendant hasn't shown any kind of cases where a clause like this was interpreted the way it was. I think if this court looks at analogous cases such as Destination Travel versus McElhannon, 799 Pacific 2nd, 454, the Colorado Appellate Court, 1990, and Kennedy versus Gillum Development Corporation, 80 Pacific 3rd, 927, the Colorado Appellate Decision of 2003, they had to do with rescission. And I think an analogy can be made between a termination of a contract and a rescission of a contract. The Kennedy Court, at least, mentioned that the legal principle that Colorado courts have consistently applied, remedies of rescission of a contract and enforcement of a provision of the same contract, are inherently inconsistent. That even gets besides the point that there's nothing in that clause that puts the defendant on any kind of notice that it's potentially liable for Ms. Thompson's hourly rate. And it completely turns the American rule, which the Colorado courts have consistently applied, upside down. And that's the only way that the jury got to the point it's at. And I would just reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Armando Aguilar, attorney number 31441, on behalf of Plaintiff Appellee North Star Project Management, Inc. The benefit of the bargain is exactly what the jury gave the plaintiff in this case. If anything's clear from the case law on the benefit of the bargain, it's a general rule whose application varies with the nature of the specific case you're applying it to. The trial judge, as a result, and this is from case law, has wide discretion in applying the general rule of benefit of the bargain because it is a fact-specific rule. No two cases are the same. The defendants have cited no legal authority for the proposition that the application of the benefit of the bargain rule here specifically requires a comparison between the total contract cost of $226,000 to the total cost incurred by the plaintiff through the entire life of the contract, even after DLR was taken off of the project. This is not like, to make a simple analogy, this is not like the basement remodeling job where I have a contract with a contractor to remodel my entire basement for a flat fixed fee of $100,000 with no itemization or breakdown, no specifics of how much is the paint, how much is the concrete, how much is the framing, just $100,000 all in. The contractor walks off the job about halfway through. In a situation like that, the only information we have to work with for assessing damages is everything I spent to get it done, including what I paid the contractor who walked off the job, versus his total contract, which the deal was of $100,000. That's the only information we have to work with in that analogy. So you have no choice but to compare, in that analogy, you have no choice but to compare the total contract fee with the total cost incurred by the owner. Here, it's completely different. Here, this contract was split up into phases and sub-phases. I brought with me a roll-up of one of the exhibits at trial. This is in the record, Exhibit 53 at page 2. This is Exhibit C from the contract between the two parties. It's the specific deliverable payment plan is what it's called. This has the 11-month schedule for DLR's work on the project. Month one, month two, et cetera, to month 11. Yes, the total is $226,000 if you make it that far. However, every single month, I'm sorry. There are three main phases to this. There's the preliminary design phase for these few months. There's the design development phase for these few months, and then the construction documents phase here at the end. Within those phases, each phase is broken down into sub-phases, if you will, month by month. Each phase or month has a specific allocation of tasks to be done by DLR with a specific price allocated to that month for those specific tasks. By way of simple example, just to make sure this is clear when your honors are looking through the record, compliance auditing deviation documentation, specific line item. That had activity in month two, which was to render payment of $2,000 to DLR in that month for that task. Award fee findings was split into 2 months of activity, $1,092 in each month. If you add up your different tasks and different allocations specifically for those tasks in each month, you have a specific dollar amount at the end of the month. And those were the invoices that were submitted by DLR, those numbers at the bottom of the month on the chart here.
The client got paid, reimbursed by NREL for all those invoices.
Correct. My client got paid for a similar chart that was in the North Star contract with NREL, the owner. Similar chart with much bigger numbers because it included North Star specific activities and activities of North Star sub consultants. It was not a distinction as far as NREL was concerned of, well, who's doing what. It was all North Star's responsibility in that contract. If North Star got the job done itself or through a sub, it submitted invoice and said, we, North Star, got it done. Whether it was us or a sub or whatever, it's our contract, we got it done, we get the money. And yes, they got paid because they got all of those done, whether DLR did it or someone else, or North Star had to do it themselves, even though it was part of DLR's responsibilities. Now, the defendant, again, looking at Exhibit 53, the defendant was terminated after month six, looking at this chart.
Did you take care of the approximate $143,000?
Yes, precisely. And then, moving from Exhibit 53, based on that exhibit, on that chart, you can see that in any given month throughout the contract, both of the parties can stop at any time and assess the progress of the work, the value of the work done, the money owed to the defendant, and they can figure out, okay, how are we doing on the benefit of our bargain in on any given month or for any period of time, based on those numbers. Exhibit 105, I'm sorry, wrong chart. Exhibit 105, page 4. This is the chart that the jury used as a roadmap to follow our damages calculation. It's in the evidence, it's in the record, and this is where it's specifically used in showing the jury, here's how we add up our numbers, and then the jury used this when they deliberated. Exhibit 105 was part of a memo that North Star sent to DLR before firing them, detailing exactly what the company was saying DLR failed to do and how much was going to be deducted as a result. And looking at the, yes, Your Honor.
Why should we be concerned with what your client deducted for work allegedly not performed, as opposed to what your client spent to get that work performed? Given the fact, given what I perceive to be the overarching fact that your client's already gotten paid from NREL.
I'm not sure what the NREL payment adds to that analysis.
Well, from my perception, what it adds is your client's got $110,000 left of the 140,000 that NREL paid it for these services. So in deciding who gets the 110,000, why isn't our sole focus what your client spent to complete that phase of the work, you know, plus the cost to enforce element?
That is the focus.
Okay. How much did your client spend?
Well, let me show you.
Well, just tell me.
You have, she gave them a total tabulation of this is how much I'm deducting.
I see.
These adds up to $72,000 is what I'm deducting.
No, you're misunderstanding my question. I don't care what she deducted. I care what she spent.
Her testimony is she spent that money completing their work and another $19,000. To be clear, she said I deducted $1,000 for this line item and I spent it finishing your work and another $2,000 on that item.
So
if you follow the testimony,
as I understand your position here, the record testimony from North Star's principal will support that conclusion, the exhibit 105.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And to be very precise about it, page 24 and page 25 of my answer brief has all the citations in the portion of the record that was designated by defendant regarding that testimony by Leandra Thompson on behalf of North Star. I did not quote the testimony. I cited it by page and line. If you follow that testimony with exhibit 105, this chart in hand, you can follow right along with her testimony and see she spent the $72,000, and then for four of these items, she had another $19,000 that she spent. You add those two numbers together, you get I'm using round numbers, $91,000 that she spent finishing DLR's work. And then as a completely separate category of damages, you have the enforcement clause, another $60,000 for costs incurred to enforce the contract. There's no contrary evidence whatsoever in the record regarding any of these numbers or Ms. Thompson's testimony. Not that it would matter for this appeal, anyway, whether the defendant believed the evidence or not, whether this court believes that evidence or not. All that matters is Ms. Thompson said it on the stand. The jury believed it and acted accordingly. And this court, of course, is not authorized to act as a super jury to reassess and weigh the evidence, credibility of the witnesses, etc., to figure out that they don't like how the jury assessed this and just redo it anew. So that's to wrap up how the math adds up. In the end, the benefit of the bargain, North Star incurred $150,000 worth of damages. 72 plus 19 is 91, plus another 60 gets you to $150,000 of damages. North Star was already holding $110,000 that DLR had billed for, and she was holding it back because of this dispute and because of the position they were taking that DLR had not finished the job. The jury said, you've got $150,000 of damage. You're already holding $110,000 that DLR billed for. Keep that, because they didn't earn it, and you're still short $40,000. So take another $40,000 as the award, the judgment against DLR, to get you to your $150,000.
So the case really turned she testified that she spent the $72,000.
Sure.
Counsel, on that $72,000, yes. Am I correct that what your client was saying with respect to the $72,000 was, we've been billed for this $72,000, but we don't think they actually did that work?
Yes.
Okay. So DLR claimed it had done the work, billed for it. Your client's position was, out of this amount that you've billed us for, you didn't really do $72,000 of it.
That's right.
Okay. And then what you're saying is, on top of that, your client's principal testified, we spent the $72,000.
Yes.
Plus we spent $19,000.
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct. And if you read the, I don't know that my citations in the answer brief precisely get to the testimony that answers that question of explaining how you figured out how much to withhold, how much to deduct, but it's all in there. It's in the transcript. It's in the record. And DLR made it easy for some of that calculation on some of these items. For example, the final design review that you see on this chart, valued at $21,000. They didn't do any of it. The total value is $21,000. North Star deducted $21,000 because they didn't do it at all.
So that, but did North Star spend? I think you're slipping the question. Did North Star spend $21,000 to accomplish the final design review?
Yes. Yes. And to be clear, all of these items, the yellow highlighting, these last two columns on this page of one exhibit 105, where it says value not performed, those were deducted and spent by North Star. Every single one of these six figures that adds up to 72. So unequivocally, what I'm saying is the testimony was, Ms. Thompson testified she deducted, and every dollar she deducted of that $72,000, she also spent finishing the work, and it wasn't enough. She also had to spend another $19,000 to get DLR's work done.
None of those expenditures overlap the approximately $60,000 she also claims under the enforcement provision.
That is correct.
No overlap of hours, outside consultants, anything?
No.
Okay.
Now, another consideration on this benefit of the bargain issue. There's no error by the trial court on this issue for this court to even review, much less reverse. The defendant never asked for and never received a ruling by the trial court on this issue. It's an affirmative defense. The defendant did not plead, excuse me?
Exactly what affirmative defense?
The affirmative defense that the defendant is now asserting is you don't get anything unless you clear this threshold of $226,000 in costs to finish what you had contracted with us to do. And regardless of whether you consider that an affirmative defense or not, the defendant waived the argument altogether, and there's no error by the trial court to review on this issue. At the start,
and then file a post-trial motion sustain the day.
They did, with similar language to what's been briefed in on this appeal. Yes, as a J&OV motion. Because it was too late at that point. Cat's out of the bag, toothpaste is out of the tube. Again, I'm contending this was an affirmative defense. It was.
I'm sorry, I guess I don't understand that. In terms of Rule 8C, what specifically is the affirmative defense that you're saying was not pled?
The affirmative defense would be, I assume if I were drafting the pleading an affirmative defense with my answer on this, something to the effect of your recovery is precluded or limited unless you can show you've exceeded the total contract price of $226,000. Because again,
that's not an affirmative defense.
Well, Your Honor, I'm contending that that's an affirmative defense because it meets the yeah, so what test for affirmative defenses. Yeah, plaintiff, you proved every element of your claim, but so what? You don't get any money because you didn't have enough of the damages to show that you passed this threshold. In any case, the defendant never brought it up in pleadings. It's not in the answer. There was no summary judgment motion. Going into trial, the TMO, damages calculation section of the TMO, written, submitted by defendant, said, our claim is $110,000 in unpaid invoices, period. In fact, directly contrary to this $226,000 threshold theory that they assert now, the defendant's section of the TMO said, quote, DLR's scope of work was to be performed on a monthly deliverables schedule, and DLR's fee was to be paid monthly according to a deliverable payment plan, close quote. Again, referring to the chart from Exhibit C, Exhibit 53.
Save your time, which, Austin.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Thank you, Your Honors.
I'm going to respectfully disagree with counsel that this court, when it reviews Ms. Thompson's testimony, is going to find any testimony that $72,000 was spent in order to complete DLR's work. The only testimony this court's going to find is $19,000 in out-of-pocket expenses. I already cited and read the testimony to this court. As far as the $72,000 is concerned, it was simply a deduction.
That's approximately $60,000 of enforcement time.
Right. that gets into the other issue as to whether I think the case law in Colorado is that the fee shifting provisions need to be interpreted in a common sense manner. If the plaintiffs terminated a contract, how do you continue to enforce it? That's what Exhibit 136 was specifically objected to in front of the trial judge. There's about four pages, once again, of argument to the trial judge regarding Exhibit 136. When this court looks at it, there's blanks all over. Conference with AA regarding blank, preparation for depositions. I mean, that was an improper measure of damages to submit to the jury. It doesn't flow from the defendant's breach. The contract's been terminated. Once again, it doesn't put the defendant on any kind of a notice that Ms. Thompson's going to continue to bill her hourly rate until she eventually gets a judgment against you.
What else could it mean?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know what that clause means.
Let's say I'm a bank and I put a clause in that contract, in a contract to that effect. Wouldn't I be entitled to the time for my bank officers to go visit the collateral and count it and take care of it up until the trial?
Well,
what's the difference between that and what Ms. Thompson claims to have done?
Well, first of all, the clause doesn't say that. I mean, I think
it says cost to enforce.
Cost to enforce. That's it. When you terminate the contract, how are you enforcing the contract?
I mean, enforcing it by, well, because that's part of your right that survives termination. Well, this isn't a rescission case.
Well, I know it's not a rescission case, Your Honor, but I think the analogy, like I said earlier, can be made with those rescission cases. Is how do you, that seems inherently inconsistent. If you're terminating a contract, how are you continuing to bill against it at the time of the termination? This is what was owed. This is what the defendant was entitled to. Now you're continuing to bill against it to the point where now you've got a verdict against the defendant, and that's left to the jury to decide. I mean, it shouldn't have been submitted to the jury if we're going to argue about this clause later and who's a prevailing party. There's also an attorney's fees clause that was argued as well. Real quick with the prejudgment interest, there was no testimony that the defendant ever was withholding anything. So how exactly the defendant got charged with prejudgment interest is also an error, Your Honor. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.